Okay, I'm going to suggest that this is the right time to start. My name is Professor Chris Alden. I'm with the International Relations Department. We're very pleased to have as a guest today Professor Kweku Ampier from Leeds University, who has is a known expert on matters South-South. In some sense, his background is a testimonial to that. At an early age, he decided to pursue research in Japan, and living as a young student in Ghana, and then by God, he did it. I mean, most of us talk about these things, but he did it, and on that basis, built a career and knowledge that has been translated into academic research and an advancement of the field that is unusual, and as I said, the prize goes to first movers, and you were a first mover in this respect. Professor Ampier has published a number of works. One of them relevant directly to this is The Political and Moral Imperatives of the Bandung Conference of 1955. So some of the issues he will talk about today will be brought to bear on that. But also, he wrote a book on the dynamics of Japan's relations with Africa, South Africa, Tanzania, and Nigeria. In fact, that's when we first met when I was teaching at BITS University. Finally, has edited a number of books, one of them being with Sunusha Naidoo, being Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, looking at Asia-Africa relations as well. So that's a theme that certainly has run through the work that he's done over many, many years, and for that reason he's uniquely qualified to speak on this particular topic. So if I can hand it over to you.
Thank you very much. Can I take this water and place it here since I'll be sitting here? I'm very delighted to be here. I'm actually very surprised to see that many people here, because at my university, we are right in the middle of the exams, and you can't get a quorum for anything. So I'm very grateful to see you here. I am talking about Bandung, but I will be looking specifically at the economic contents of Bandung. But I think perhaps I should start by saying that, and many of you will know this, the Bandung Conference was multidimensional in many respects. But for some reason, the discourse about Bandung tends to be unidimensional in the way that the discourse tends to focus more on the political imperatives of the conference. I'm intrigued by that. As a result of that sort of narrowness of the sort of examination of the conference, the narrative about the event repetitively revolves around a handful of themes: anti-colonialism, decolonization, the rise of the so-called third world. And of course, post-war historians will analyze the Bandung Conference in the context of the Cold War, which invariably brings into perspective the problematic of imperialism and the neutralist inclinations of the conference, or at least the neutralist inclinations of some of the participants at the conference. So that's the problem that I am in one sense taking my cue from. Recently, though, some very interesting research have appeared about the conference, and I'd like to mention a couple of these, if I may. Firstly, because casual remarks are often made about the link between the Bandung Conference and the non-aligned movement, E.T. Abrahams' article of 2008 interrogates that aspect of the narrative and argues that, confidently he does, argues that there are no links, or that there's no link between the Bandung Conference and the non-aligned movement. A credible argument, I think, but then one could also argue contrary to that, because there are clearly evidence of the remnants of the Bandung Conference in the non-aligned movement. The second piece of research that I would like to mention is by Robert Vitalis, I think that's the name, who in 2013 published an interesting but wickedly cynical article about what he refers to as the phantom of Kwame Nkrumah's attendance at the conference. What Vitalis does is that he raises questions about the nature of the research surrounding the Bandung Conference, and intermittently he sort of takes shot at those who mention that Nkrumah was at the conference. And indeed, Nkrumah was nowhere near the conference. As a matter of fact, the Colonial Office and the Foreign Office were very glad that Nkrumah was not at the conference, because had he been at the conference, he would have made or ranted against British colonialism and imperialism and neocolonialism. So they were very glad that Nkrumah was safe in the Prime Minister's residence in Accra. So Vitalis is absolutely right that Nkrumah was not at the conference. Lastly, I should mention Naoko Shimazu's fascinating article, which explores the cultural content of the Bandung Conference, a novelty in that sense. The conference, according to Shimazu, was pure theater. A soap opera, as she put it, reinforced by the national cultural artifacts that the delegates paraded at the conference. So these are the most recent interesting sort of reflections on the Bandung Conference. My current research is about the economic content of the conference, and it attempts to evoke the aspirations of the countries at the conference for industrialization and economic development. My argument is very simple, as a matter of fact. Without invoking the principles of econometrics, I very simply argue that the economic development, or better still, economic development was the most pressing concerns of the participants at the conference. There's a twist to this argument, though, and it is that somehow, obviously because of the political circumstances at the time, not with the expanding chill of the Cold War, the political content of the conference overwhelmed the economic content of the conference. In other words, the political issues managed to hijack the conference. The analysis that I'm making will reflect on Japan's role in what I refer to as the economic content of the conference, not least because Japan was at the conference, and to some extent, Japan subsequently became very instrumental in the economic development of Southeast Asia. And I would argue that there is a correlation between Japan's role at the conference and what Japan subsequently did in Southeast Asia in particular, but subsequently in the whole of East Asia. I will also briefly mention Burma's, that is Myanmar's now, 1954 five-year economic development plan, just to make a point, but I will reserve that point until later. Perhaps I should give some background information about the conference. it was a movement. The Bandung Conference was, as a matter of fact, a movement that articulated the post-colonial aspirations of the political leaders of Asia and Africa. And the emphasis here is on political leaders, because to some extent, the people of Asia and Africa were bystanders. They weren't really involved in what was happening in Bandung at all. As a movement, the conference inspired what the left in Paris referred to as Le Tiers Monde. That's the third world, symbolic of the emancipation of Asia and Africa from Western domination. The media frenzy about the conference was electrifying. And I've had a chance to look at media or newspaper commentaries about the conference from the middle of 1954 till the end of 1955. And the commentaries are very exciting indeed. On the one hand, they predict an impending war between the West and the Asian and the African countries. On the other, they play up the movement, that is the Bandung Conference, as the middle ground in the Cold War between the superpowers, right? But then, of course, there were newspaper commentaries, especially in the United States, that branded the Bandung Conference as a meeting of communists, the Reds. And then, of course, in Britain, the newspapers, or some newspapers at the very least, referred to, you know, the participants as fellow travelers, obviously referring to communism. Anyhow, the conference bristled with energy and activity. And some of you might know this, the Bandung generation, or those that I refer to as the Bandung generation, the Asians and the Africans who grew up around the Bandung Conference still remember the conference sentimentally and emotionally. I was talking to a Japanese man when I was doing my research, and he had goose pimples on his body when he was talking about the conference. So that is very interesting indeed. Right. A little more background information about the conference. It took place, well, actually, the official title of the conference was Asia-Africa Conference. And it took place in Bandung from the 18th to the 24th of April, 1955. That's 6 days. As a matter of fact, most of the delegates were in Bandung for more than 8 days. Some were there for 10 days. But those were the days when political leaders had the luxury of time to meet and talk about international issues. As a matter of fact, the Bretton Woods Conference was from July the 1st to the 22nd. That's a long stretch of time. The Berlin Conference, they would often say it was from 1884 to 1885, right? Now, it was actually from the November 1884, the 5th of November 1884, I think, to the 19th of February 1885. So almost 3 months. Just imagine the G20 meeting for even a week. I mean, the anarchists and the anti-capitalists will have a field day, you know? But I suppose that luxury of time is no longer with us, even in international affairs. 5 countries sponsored the conference: Indonesia, India, Burma, Ceylon, and Pakistan. And of course, according to Nehru, the Prime Minister of India, the conference was an awakening of Asia. President Sukarno also remarked that the conference marked the political emergence in world affairs of over half of the world's population. And of course, the stated aims of the conference according to the final communique of the conference, was firstly to promote Afro-Asian economic and cultural cooperation, and then opposition to racism, colonialism, and neocolonialism. There were a couple of precedents before the conference itself. There was a meeting of these five leaders on the 28th of April to the 2nd of May in 1954 in Colombo. And, of course, they agreed then to have another conference or a meeting in Bogor in the same year, 1954, but in December 28th to the 29th. It was confirmed at Bogor that the Asian African Conference should take place. According to Nehru, the object of the meeting should be to create an atmosphere of cooperation. But interestingly, he was also emphasizing the need to place Asia and Africa in the picture because the center was no longer holding, obviously because of the Cold War. The conference, as they discussed it, should contribute to the reconstruction of the economies of the participating countries. And then, of course, at Bogor, they had to decide which countries to invite to the conference, you see. And that was quite interesting. They decided very quickly, without much trouble, that South Korea and North Korea would not be invited to the conference because they were at war with each other. And then they also said that the Soviet Asian republics, although they were in Asia, would not be invited to the conference because they were aligned, in a sense. They couldn't be neutral. Now, one of the things that these leaders among themselves agreed on was neutrality in the context of the Cold War, right? So because the Soviet Asian republics couldn't be neutral, they wouldn't invite the Soviet Asian republics. The interesting issue here is the invitation of Japan. Japan was also aligned, you see, aligned to the United States because of the U.S.-Japan alliance. But the sponsors could not ignore Japan. They had to invite Japan, partly because Muhammad Ali of Pakistan wanted Japan to attend the conference. But they were all in agreement that Japan should come. And part of my argument is that, in part, they invited Japan because they knew that Japan was the economic powerhouse of Asia and that they would need at least to engage with Japan in regards to the economic development of the region, and therefore Japan was invited. They stipulated that the head of the delegations would either be the head of state, the prime minister, or the foreign minister. Now, this is crucial to my analysis. They came up with a list of countries that would attend the conference, and officially it is said that in the narrative that six African countries would be part of the conference, and then the rest would be Asian countries. Okay, this is the narrative. But according to my personal configuration of the geographical arrangement of the participants, this is what we have. We have 18 Asian countries, 6 African countries, and then 8 from the Middle East and Persia. This is how I configure it, to show the dynamism of the group, to also show the differences between the sociocultural differences amongst the group. I mean, many of these countries did not agree with each other ideologically. There were also quite a number of personality politics that, to some extent, undermined the fluency of the conference, if you are aware of this. For example, of course, India and Pakistan were at loggerheads in regards to Kashmir. And these two, the leaders of these two countries couldn't even look at each other except when they were shouting at each other. So there was a certain kind of commotion at the conference. Because of that, Brands in 1999 wrote that Bandung as a metaphor lacks position because the membership was amorphous. It was to a very large extent fractured. But one thing, to some extent, held them together. The idea of economic cooperation and the belief that somehow they should be able to surmount the, you know, the second-class sort of citizenship that is attached to them in the context of international geopolitics. Let me say a little bit about my work on Bandung Conference before I go on to my actual topic. I became interested in the conference when I was a graduate student and proceeded subsequently to write a book on the topic. My research revolved around essentially the reactions of three countries to the conference. The reactions of the United States, Britain, and Japan. And I sort of looked at the archival documents to find out exactly what was going on in these countries when the conference was being arranged. And of course, what I found out is that the United States was hopelessly worried about the ideological content of the conference. They were also worried about, you know, the idea of Pan-Asianism, because they thought that for some reason, if Pan-Asianist ideals thrived in Asia, then the United States would be sidelined. They were also very worried about the participation of the PRC in the conference. And, of course, the question of neutralism, which is always a problem in the State Department, at the very least, was of much concern. Britain was not too much worried about the ideological content of the conference. They were more concerned about the issue of colonialism and how the participants at the conference were going to, as it were, attack the European colonialists. Japan was very glad to be invited to the conference because it wanted to, as it were, redeem itself from the history of the war, you see. But it also wanted to engage these countries in regards to economic cooperation or economic development in that region. But the truth of the matter is that Japan was interested in the raw materials in Southeast Asia at the very least, okay? But of course, Japan also had ambitions to be the leader of Asia after the war. You would find out when you look at U.S. archives about the Bandung Conference that John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, was the person who embodied what I call the U.S.'s abhorrence of the conference. And the U.S. attitude towards the conference evolved. Firstly, they wanted to dismiss the conference completely. They wanted to act as if the conference was not going to happen. In fact, they tried to completely undermine the conference. And then subsequently, when they found out that their friends, that is the friends of the United States, like the Philippines and indeed Japan, and of course Pakistan, wanted to attend the conference, the United States' attitude shifted to what I refer to as benevolent indifference. And then subsequently, they came to accept it reluctantly, but then they tried to manipulate the conference and use it to U.S.'s own interest. One of the commentaries that comes out of the archives is what is here. The department, that is the State Department, continues to be concerned about the implications of the Afro-Asian Conference, as they called it, because of communist influence, because the main purpose of the communists will be to divide the free Asian countries from their Western friends, and on and on and on. And then, of course, they're saying, unless the non-communist countries exercised utmost caution and alertness, they will find themselves joining in adoption of resolutions suggesting common purpose with the communists. So the United States was quite, at the very least, the State Department was very worried that the friends of the United States were going to change camp, as it were. And they were particularly worried about the participation of Zhou Enlai at the conference. So what happened was that, although the United States was not invited to the conference, of course not, the U.S. in actual fact did participate in the conference, as I would argue. They had agents. Quite a number of pseudo-journalists, most of whom were African-Americans, right? Asia-Africa conference. So, of course, anyone who was Asian or African or black in that sense would be able to sort of go there and blend in, as it were. And as a result of that, Kerry Fraser argues that although the United States was not invited to the conference, it thoroughly participated in the conference. In the end, I think that the U.S. was very happy with the outcome of the conference. The State Department's internal report says that the conference had been favorable to the interest of the United States because they had people like the ambassador of the Philippines to the United Nations, Romulo, who was, as the Filipino newspapers called him, the voice of America. And there were a number of delegates who spoke on behalf of the United States. Anyway, in view of the time, I think I would move a bit faster. I am interested in the economic content of the conference. And I will refer you to the final communique, the first bit of which talks about economic cooperation among the Asian and the African countries. And the statements here underline the points that I'm trying to make. There was general consensus, desire, if you like, for economic cooperation among the participants at the conference. And, of course, they talked about how it would be to their benefit to cooperate for technical assistance amongst themselves, to have experts, trainees, pilot projects, and equipment for demonstration purposes, so as to help each other to develop economically. They also talked about the need for the United Nations to provide special funds for economic development. And, of course, in that regard, I suppose what we cannot overlook here is the fact that they knew that they couldn't independently, on their own, develop the economies, and that they would have to get support, assistance from the international community, especially the developed nations, including institutions like the World Bank, of course. Now I want to reflect a little bit on the Japanese participation in the conference, because I think it's quite crucial. See, Japan was invited to participate in the conference, as I argue, because of its economic stature in the region. Japan had obviously lost the war, you see, and it was for about a period of about 8 years or so, weakened economically. But from 1954 onwards, the Japanese economy was doing very well. And Japan has started paying reparations to quite a number of the countries in that region. Japan wanted to engage economically with the countries in the region, not least because it wanted to get natural resources from these regions. When the Japanese agreed to attend the conference, they organized some kind of a workshop within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Japan that went on for quite a number of weeks, and they decided how to approach the conference, what to do and what not to do. And in regards to what not to do, they stated very clearly, and this is evident in the archival papers, that they will avoid making any comments that would have political connotations. So when it came to issues in regards to colonialism, they wouldn't say anything. They wouldn't say anything that I suppose the European countries would be offended by, for example. They weren't going to say anything about Taiwan either. The problem between China and Taiwan was something that they were going to avoid. What they were going to do, however, was to emphasize the importance of economic cooperation amongst the Asian and the African countries. What is also interesting here is that I said earlier that the head of the delegation would have to be either the head of state, a prime minister, or a foreign minister. The person that they sent to the conference was neither. He was a bloke who happened to have political connections in Japan. In fact, he was elected to the House of Representatives in Japan, but not because he was a politician. It was simply because he had money. He had business connections in Japan. He also had business connections across the length and breadth of Asia, because at one point, during the period of Japan's imperialism, he was the chairman of the Manchurian Industrial Development. Right? So this connected him with all sorts of very important institutions and people in Asia. He also was the first head of what they called at the time the Economic Planning Agency, which was affiliated to the Ministry of International Trade and Industry. That monumental institution in Japan that basically, according to some observers, built post-war Japan. Anyway, the name of this man was Takasaki Tatsunosuke. And in his speech at the conference, he just talked about how Japan was anxious to contribute to its share to promote the economic cooperation and development of the region. That was a refrain that constantly emerged in his pronouncements. And he wasn't talking politics. He had been instructed by the Minister of Foreign Affairs to refrain from any political issues or making comments about political issues that might make some other countries angry. What is interesting is that he met twice with Zhou Enlai. Now, you can imagine how the United States or the State Department would have reacted to that. He met twice with Zhou Enlai, and of course, you know, the State Department didn't like it. Japan's economic proposal for the cooperation in the region was interesting. It talked about the need to grow the economy, to industrialize, so that the countries would be more productive and would also be able to create employment. That's one of the things that the Japanese were emphasizing. They talked about the need to promote technical cooperation that suited the actual conditions of the region. Very important point, because they had been observing what the World Bank had been doing. The World Bank had this one template that supposedly fit every form of development, every country's development. And the Japanese were saying that, look, we need to speak to each country's economic needs. And on the basis of that, we would devise ways and means to help those countries to develop. So basically, that is how the Japanese wanted to approach the development, the economic development in the region. I want to mention Burma's economic development plan just briefly. Burma, as you know, was one of the sponsors of the conference. They were, at the time, at least from the perspective of the State Department, socialists, yeah, and therefore a worry to the United States. They went to the conference with an economic plan, which they distributed to the conference participants. And one of the things that they talked about was the need for the nations or the countries to unite and help each other with their technical skills, if they had any. But the point I want to make here is that the Burmese did not write their five-year economic plan themselves. They contracted a U.S. think tank to write that plan, Robert R. Nathan Associates, the consultant economist to the Burmese government. What is interesting is that before the company gave a copy of that plan to Burma, to the Burmese government, they'd actually given a copy to the CIA. So the CIA already knew what the Burmese were supposedly doing with their economic development plan. And the point I want to make here is that, you see, the United States was politicizing the conference. And this is one of the reasons why the political issues, in a sense, overwhelmed the economic issues that the participants wanted to talk about. So, very quickly, some of you may know how Japan, to some extent, has contributed to the economic development of Southeast Asia. I find that sort of narrative very interesting, not least because I see some kind of a linkage between what the Japanese were saying at the conference and what actually happened subsequently, in the sense that, to a very large extent, the development of the economies of Southeast Asia were handled by the Japanese, if I may put it that way. Comparatively speaking, if we're looking at, you know, responsibilities of former colonial powers or hegemonic powers in terms of economic development, I mean, we couldn't say possibly in any way that the United Kingdom, the UK, has been able to do anything comparable to what the Japanese have done in Southeast Asia, for example, in Africa or anywhere else. Nor can we say that the United States contributed to or has contributed massively to the economic development of the Latin American countries. So there's an interesting sort of narrative here to look at if we can properly compare these issues. Something that I might perhaps mention as a sample of what the Japanese have been able to do in Southeast Asia is the eastern seaboard of Thailand. It's some kind of a hub station for economic development. It has its problems, but Thailand is no longer a basket case of economic problems. Let me conclude very quickly. So the argument that I've sort of pursued here is that the political issues managed to sort of overwhelm the economic content of the conference. And therefore, when researchers talk about Bandung, they sort of go on in circles about the political content of the conference, completely ignoring the other components of the conference, the cultural content of the conference, for example, and indeed, most importantly, the economic content of the conference. I think I'll end here.
Great. Thank you very much.